Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is presented by Meta.
Virtual reality training platforms like ForgeFX allow welding students to learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Hey everyone, welcome back to EU Confidential. I'm your host, Ryan Heath, the political editor at Politico Europe, and you're listening to the number one EU politics podcast. This week has been a game of geopolitical ping pong, with the ball bouncing around from the EU Arab League summit in Egypt to the India-Pakistan border and on to the US-North Korea summit in Vietnam. So it's good to know the UK has been looking at its navel the whole time in another round of confusing delays and amendments to its Brexit plans. Nothing is certain, of course, but the sheer lack of time now means that Brexit is unlikely to happen on March 29, and if it does, it probably won't be an orderly Brexit. All that hassle and drama on our doorstep makes this week's interview all the nicer to listen to. We've got the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, as our guest. And guess what? I didn't ask her about her beautiful new baby or her stay-at-home partner. I just asked about what she thinks about the world. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. In the podcast panel, we discuss the dangers of dialogue with dictators and what a public body should do when one of its staff stands trial for raping his junior colleague. But first, I give you the youngest female leader in the world, Jacinda Ardern. Jacinda and I spoke in front of a small office here at the Politico offices in Brussels, and the background noise you can hear at the beginning, that's the bubbles rising in a glass of sparkling water that was sitting on the table in between us.
I thought maybe if we begin a little bit with your political style and philosophy, so people can get the big picture, and then we'll go into some of the more granular policy details. When I was hearing we'd be doing this interview, I was thinking about how, in a lot of ways, you remind me, or in fact, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez reminds me of you, and that, you know, she does her little Instagram stories cooking noodles or whatever, but I've seen you doing those videos.
She's got a handful more followers than I do, I
just
should
a
add.
Few, just a few. But what I mean is really interesting is your very authentic way of communicating. You know, you announce you're running for a different seat and you're doing it barreling down the highway at 100 kilometres an hour in a Facebook video.
Speed limit.
She wasn't driving. She was just in the car. Yeah. But I guess my point there is that we're seeing lots and lots of contrasting styles now in politics, whether it's generational, technological, some of it's ideologically divided as well. And I wanted to get a sense of how natural that is for you. Yeah. Is it something where you've just decided you really want to invest in communications, or are you just putting yourself out there and being as much you as you can?
I would love to sit here and say that there is some particular strategy behind exactly what we're doing or I'm doing when it comes to social media engagement or even in style, but there's not. You know, some of it therefore may indeed be generational, because when I came into Parliament, I probably would have been amongst a few who actually came in already having, as a private citizen, a Facebook page. So that was probably a generational shift, whereas, you know, many of my contemporaries then were adopting those tools from the position of already having been a politician. And maybe that means you approach it differently. But my approach from the beginning in engaging in those forums was just being myself, because it was the place I engaged with my friends and my family. So why would I create any particular veneer or otherwise? So that may be part of it. Maybe another side of the coin is simply coming from an environment where we are under 5 million people. You know, as a politician, you will still have substantial political discussions while you're doing your grocery shopping. So, you know, I take the approach of just being myself, not being afraid to therefore present some human frailty, because there's no harm in people seeing that politicians despite perhaps what's grown over the years, that politicians are humans, yep. They make mistakes, but they're there often. I said this about both sides, often for very good reason, good motivation.
You took the word out of my mouth. It was kind of like speaking human was what I was thinking of. Yeah. And my dad says hello, and he was like, oh, I really like the way she talks. I love her accent, and I love the way she talks. And this is a guy who you normally start a political conversation with. He's like, well, that Trump, he's right about da-da-da-da. And you're like, ooh. And so you've broken through in some way, even with people who don't have that intuitive interest in politics.
Maybe I haven't spent too much time forming theories as well, but you know, there was no time to be groomed as leader because the moment I became leader, a campaign started, so I only had the choice to be myself.
Yep.
And I guard that. I do my own social media.
All of it, okay.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. So it's all me. Yep. So I run my own channel, and I always will.
Very good. Mm. And what part
that's
of the job...
It's a bit sporadic. No. Sometimes. Patchy.
What part of the job comes least naturally to you, or that surprised you since you came into office?
I guess I had the benefit of having observed it from the inside. Mm. I worked for 3 years in the New Zealand Parliament, but I worked for a year directly for Helen Clark. So that gave me a bit of insight into the job. It gave me a bit of insight into the time it took, into just the scale of briefings, or, you know, little nitty-gritty bits and pieces. But as with politics generally, because I observed, you know, politics for a long time before I went into it, no one can ever teach you how it feels. Mm. How it feels is just an exaggeration of what it is to be a member of parliament generally.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, I thought I'd do something innovative in this interview, which was not ask you about your partner or your beautiful new baby, but just leave it out there that I think it's great that someone who's 38 can show that something like this is possible, to have all those things going on.
So, thank you.
Yeah,
but without being a superhuman person.
Exactly, and the reality of it as well. Yep. Like, I don't think you're holding anything back about
logistical nightmare.
Yeah,
I'll just leave it at that.
Well, let's switch to some of those policy areas now where you're innovating. The wellbeing budget was something that really caught my eye. Mm. When we talk about budgets in Europe, it's often because someone in Brussels is nagging a national government because they haven't done the hard work of economic reforms, right, or they've let the deficit blow out or whatever. And you're really trying to sort of go beyond GDP.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell us a bit about that? And I'm just guessing there are going to be some skeptics and critics who think it's all a bit hippy-dippy. So what would you say to those people?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd say that actually I think probably there's a fair amount of consensus that GDP is an inadequate measure of success. In fact, the architects of GDP never intended it to be used as the thermometer that it is used to the extent that it is used. I think it was even Robert Kennedy who said GDP measures just about everything except that which makes life worthwhile. So this is probably an idea that's had its time. In fact, the OECD has done its own work trying to encourage economies to use indicators and measures that go beyond GDP. So we've really grasped what they've developed, and we've utilised that to create our own set of measures. We've created a living standards framework. It's held by Treasury. It measures across the four capitals to really try and get a well-rounded view of New Zealand's well-being. Now, that's not new yet. A lot of economies and countries are doing that, and for good reason, and I'll come to that in a second. But the bit that's different for us is that we've said, well, that's all well and good, but how does it change your decision-making? Now, it's one thing every year to just have a little look at the graphs and the pie charts and say what's different, but what we've decided to do is, for instance, retool some of our existing infrastructure. So our Public Finance Act, already we've changed the Public Finance Act so that we have to report annually on our child poverty figures.
Mm-hmm.
We have to set targets to reduce child poverty, and we have to create a child wellbeing strategy. That in itself isn't a policy metric, but what gets measured gets done. So now successive governments will give cause at every budget for governments to say, what have we done to improve child wellbeing, which we know through evidence affects everything. We've also will be amending the Public Finance Act so that we have to set wellbeing priorities each year, and our first wellbeing budget will require ministers to demonstrate how their spending priorities will improve intergenerational wellbeing. So it's really about changing the way we do policy.
Now, another topic that's often framed in moral terms is climate change, and you're very big on that as well. I mean, it just strikes me that more and more of the facts are piling up now, and that even maybe some things like the Paris Climate Agreement aren't really enough to get us where we need to get as a planet. What is the scale of transformation that we need to be engaging in your view, in the New Zealand government's view, to actually get out of this?
What strikes me in our region is it's, of course, not a hypothetical in our region. It's clear the difference between the harm to our ecosystems, our biodiversity, through a difference of 1.5 and 2 degrees. In New Zealand, our goal as a government is to put in place some infrastructure that takes us away from electoral cycles on climate change. Because in the same way that you can't actually make significant changes on child poverty in 3 years, you can't make significant change on climate change in 3 years. And so that enduring infrastructure, if I can one day when I'm out of politics look back and still see that that exists, then we will have done our job. So we're at the moment drafting our climate legislation that will embed targets, that will create a mechanism for carbon budgeting, that will bring in an independent climate commission. And all of that is about creating an enduring approach.
And can that sort of thing align with the EU's systems? Because just hearing you talk like that, it reminds me a lot of seven-year EU budgeting and things like that.
And we've actually borrowed from what we've seen abroad in order to inform what we're doing, taking the best from overseas examples, but also at the same time taking our own path on some of our ambition. We've said we want to be 100% renewable by 2035, and we're over 80% now.
And that's mostly hydro?
So we're very lucky with our wind and our hydro in particular. So we know we need to take our ambition beyond that. We last year announced that we would not be issuing any further oil and gas exploration permits offshore New Zealand. Now, there's only a handful of countries who have done that. That was significant, but we did it because we know we need to transition parts of our economy. And so we are now working on elements of that transition now, investing in hydrogen initiatives and so on.
Now, kindness was not a word that I thought would just get attached into a political debate. But you had this really interesting session with Prince William,
yes.
And it was around mental health in Davos.
Yeah.
And you just sort of put it out there that you just think we need to be more kind to each other.
Mm.
And that was all part of this mental health debate. What was the thinking behind that? What made you want to be part of that?
On mental health, the reason for participating in that for me is linked into the wellbeing conversation, ultimately. In fact, it is one of our five priorities. This budget is mental health. And why? Well, there's estimates that it affects our GDP by up to 5%. We have an extraordinary number of people in New Zealand trying to access mental health services. And we have some of the highest youth suicide rates in the OECD. So it is both a moral and economic issue for us. For me, moral.
Yep.
And actually, taking an approach of kindness and empathy, I think, is probably a natural reaction in a space like mental health and wellbeing. We need to remove stigma, and we need to ensure that we create an environment where people are able to access the service they need. And we need to take a preventative approach, look after people's health before it becomes acute. What's probably different is that I use the word kindness in lots of forums, not just talking about mental health, but actually just an approach to politics. And it wasn't a planned thing. I think it's just, if I wanted to summarize for me what we needed to do differently, it was about bringing into politics values that we actually teach our kids. But for some reason, when you get to that level of leadership, we drop all of those things that we think are so critical to making healthy societies. And we say, no, actually, we expect our politicians to be assertive and brash and bold and well, to lie. And we just expect that. Well, why don't we expect the same kind of behaviours that we want our kids to learn? So I that's why, for me, it's about modelling some of those traits and values that really make a society what it should be.
Now, maybe we can switch to more of the nitty-gritty and the current hot topics. I thought we'd start with Brexit and then segue into the broader trade stuff and the trade deal you're working on. You met with Theresa May on the way to Davos. What was that like? You seem very different people on the surface, you know, party, generation, sort of the way you conduct your politics. But is there like a secret solidarity of people who just got this big burden of running a country and never being able to take a day off?
Do you know what? I think actually that in a way, to a certain degree, exists for politicians who work together frequently in the international domain. You know, regardless of which side of the fence you come on, you build these working relationships, and you have a bit of an understanding of the other person's life. Different scales, of course, New Zealand versus the UK and so on, but we have a good working relationship, and as we should, given particular the relationship between New Zealand and the UK.
Yeah. Now, I forgot the one fun thing that we do in these interviews. We do a rapid fire questions.
That's not fun. That's not
No, it
fun.
Is fun. It's hugely
it's
fun.
It's only fun for
no.
you.
No, 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 because we've come from Davos, and so we're going to play a little Davos game where we compete against each other to see who had the most over-the-top experience. And we both answer. So it's like it's fair. We're both participating.
Do I get a copy? No. If you wrote them, that is not fair.
That is silent. It's true. I've written out my answer. But they're easy ones to respond to.
Okay.
Who did you do your first double takeover? In the sense of where you're like, oh my God, that was dot, dot, dot.
Oh, I did do a second over the shoulder when I saw Tony Blair.
Okay.
Just
for me, Robin Wright, the House of Cards actress.
Yeah, right.
How many times
Clearly
did
I was in the politics corner while you were somewhere else. Yeah.
How many times did you slip on the ice?
Oh, I think the New Zealand team were very prepared for. They constantly had me with those little grippy things. So I actually didn't slip once.
Okay.
Yeah.
Once. I said once. How many royals did you chat with?
One. Oh, no, excuse me. Three. Four.
Two. Two.
Yeah, two, I think. I
got Prince Haakon in Norway and Queen Rania, but you got William and three others, obviously.
Yeah.
Okay, who was the most powerful person or group you met with?
Do you know what? From purely power in the form of soft power, Sir David Attenborough.
Oh, wow. Okay, you win.
That was great.
I got Sheryl Sandberg and Tony Blair in the room at once.
Well, that's quite something.
But it's less cool. You're 3-1 off here. Now, the Dutch government was jamming 8 people into each hotel room to save money. How many people slept in your hotel room / apartment?
So when you say that, are you telling me that the Prime Minister...
No. I think a series of advisors and security guards might have bunked
in the
up.
Same. There was some bunking in the delegation, but not much.
Okay.
I, however, will put on record that I offered.
Okay. That's, well,
I was told that wasn't...
6. I win this one. We had 6 in our
apartment. Did you? Yes. But I did offer. Yeah.
And who
was I offered the Minister of Finance. I was like, we're just here. We'll be fine. We go way back.
I hope his wife or partner is okay with that. But
he would have been fine.
And who was your favourite celebrity that you came across?
Sir David Attenborough.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's every time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yours?
Bonner.
Ah. Yeah. What did you talk about?
We didn't. I just
okay.
Didn't.
Okay.
And I was more like, is that hair real? And then my boss, Matthew Kaminsky, who was like, definitely not real, it's definitely dyed. I was like, I think it's just unwashed.
You should have asked. That would have been a great conversation. Do you wash your
hair? That's a great
hair?
Conversation that opener, isn't it? Now let's get back into some of the serious stuff. You have said that New Zealand and Europe, like, they're the natural partners. I think Helen Clark talked about New Zealand being like the 28th member state. What is it precisely that means New Zealand makes this investment in this relationship? Because there's a bunch of other countries that kind of go like, ugh, Europe, it's old. Like, so we're all about China.
Yeah, I think probably two things. One that's extra weight on that in this particular point in time, and one that's, you know, that I think Helen Clark would have particularly been putting emphasis on, and that is just our shared values. You know, democracy, human rights, our belief in multilateralism and rules-based order. You know, I think that has always mattered. But current context, that context that matters even more now. And so I think that's, for us, this is not just about an economic relationship. It is about much, much more than that.
Now, the next thing on the table is the EU-New Zealand Free Trade Agreement negotiations.
Yes.
One of the things that you campaigned on was having strict labour and environmental clauses and making sure that those are included in any deals that you're going to be involved in. What do you think is the scope for having some really strong enforcement?
We actually campaigned generally for high quality free trade agreements.
Yep.
We campaigned for also bringing in civic society more on New Zealand's side when we are engaged in, you know, building a mandate for our trade agreements, involving people more. And we've broadly started a trade for all agenda. And that was actually in response to the TPP negotiations, mm-hmm. because what we saw is trade deals were evolving, and there's actually, you know, labour standards and environmental standards that really lift the game in that agreement, but people didn't feel like they were benefiting from trade. Probably a proxy for feeling not like they were benefiting from globalization generally. So for us, this is about saying we can model high quality free trade agreements. We've pitched that to the EU. We think that there's real benefit to modeling that, because ultimately I think, you know, that's one way we can demonstrate the benefit of trade, and that actually more people can benefit from them if we work a bit harder.
What are you going to prioritise in saying that this is what we really want out of the trade deal? Like the must-have rather than the nice-to-have?
I'm not going to prioritise. Your starting point is everything.
Okay.
Of course, our starting point is always to go for the best outcomes we can, but I'm not going to name industries at this point.
Fair enough. And now one of the examples where that can become a problem is a split up between the EU27 and the UK.
Yep.
You're one of quite a few countries that's got a problem with how the two parties have tried to do it so far.
Yeah.
Run through a little bit how important that is to you and where you see that headed.
Yeah, look, for us, this is just a matter of maintaining this, really, the status quo. Mm-hmm. We're not asking for any more than what we already have. Yeah. As I've heard our ambassador say, not one more kilo of butter, not one kilo less. We're just seeking the status quo. Yeah. And actually just seeking a fulfillment of the commitment that was made by both the UK and the EU that we wouldn't be worse off.
Yep.
So that means maintaining the flexibility. And so at the moment what's being proposed does not maintain the flexibility of trade between New Zealand, the UK, New Zealand and the EU. Mm-hmm. And so that's all we seek.
Yep.
We continue to maintain that dialogue. We've got creative solutions that we think mean the EU would be no worse off, but we're just seeking that discussion. Mm-hmm. It's still in play.
Thank you so much, Prime Minister, for joining us. Best of luck with your engagement with the EU and your future endeavours.
I appreciate that. Thanks very much.
That was Jacinda Ardern. Next up, the podcast panel. Welcome back to the podcast panel, Alva Finn.
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Lena.
Hi, Lena.
Hi, Ryan. Hi, Alva.
So we've got a couple of items on the agenda this week. Let's kick off with the EU League of Arab States summit that was taking place Sunday and Monday in the Egyptian resort of Sharm el-Sheikh. It's technically the first EU Arab summit. That's because it's happening at leaders level. They've met at ministerial level before, but never with all of the leaders. Very interesting summit, really, because the Arab countries don't really have a consensus on much, and the EU is heavily divided on migration, which was the official topic of the summit. So I think that brings us to our first question, is the EU actually being strategic in this summit, or is it actually just by default cozying up to strongmen and other authoritarian leaders?
Definitely very strategic. It's a very important region. It's a vital region. There are so many things in common between Europe and the Arab states. Unfortunately, it came very, very late.
So that's not very strategic then, is it?
Very late, certainly because of the ministerial meetings have been going on and on since long time ago. Of course, don't forget we had so many upheavals and the Arab Spring and so many things happened in the Arab world which really prevented of convening leaders together. Definitely, I don't see it just about the strongmen. Each country has a leader when we're, so many of us are fond of our leaders, but it's about the people. And it's always the question for the EU, is it about values or about interests? So as much as there are values that the EU would like to inspire and work with other regions, whether in Latin America or Africa or the ASEAN, I mean, there are strongmen everywhere, even with President Trump. There's still a possibility to sit and dialogue and talk and get to know each other. One of the things that it's really important to underline here is that we have very young European leaders, that they've never been in the Arab world. On a political level, they didn't meet many of the Arab leaders.
Sebastian Kurz was 25 when the Arab Spring took place.
Yeah, imagine. Or the Prime Minister of Luxembourg or the Prime Minister of Ireland. So as well, we have very good encounters. I think the dialogue is important. Now, what are the outcomes? I'm not sure about it. When I read the declaration, it was very sad. But still, it's the beginning of many things, I hope, in the future with the next commission to work better.
Is dialogue enough, Alva?
I think you do have to keep lines of communication open with everyone. I mean, famously, the US were propping up the former Libyan dictator for a long time and Mubarak, you know. So I think that, I mean, this is nothing new. The other thing is that not all, as Lena said, not all leaders of the Arab League are strong men. You know, some of them are democratically elected. You've got like Tunisia as well, for example.
Definitely.
So some of them are.
And they did keep Syria out. Let's not forget.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I think that human rights has always been a tricky thing with, for example, Egypt. I think a lot of the focus, the media attention was on the fact that it was in Egypt and the crackdown on human rights, but also detainees. And the thing is that that was also the case with Mubarak, right? And it's a problem with a lot of these very strategic partners in the region that you can't, or that they just won't listen when you say something about human rights because they know that they have power over you. And I think that's the case with Egypt. It's a very important partner in the region for a number of different conflicts and then also on things like migration. So I think it's really important that they go and meet, but I don't see anything very big coming out of this. You know, even when you read the outcome document, it's just fluff.
What about something like Bruno Le Maire, the French foreign minister, openly complaining about what is supposedly the other half of Europe's motor, the German government, who have an arms export embargo against Saudi Arabia, a country that is responsible for an awful lot of humanitarian problems in the conflict in Yemen. Obviously, the Khashoggi killing, the journalist killed in Turkey by the Saudi state. And, you know, there's plenty of misogyny running around in Saudi Arabia as well. Like, I find it amazing that France and Germany would openly fight each other the day before a summit like that over a country like Saudi Arabia.
Ryan, France and UK are experts of arms to the Saudi Arabia and to the Arab world is much, much more higher than Germany. It is 10% of what Germany exports of its arms to Saudi Arabia and JCC, while it is 60% of France and 48% of UK. And many of the components of these weapons are made in Germany. So definitely France and UK will be really upset. And that shows as well the lack of a united European security and defense policy and foreign policy, because if one country is saying, okay, we are going to not do anything when it comes to weapons to Saudi Arabia, if there were the same system and they were united and we had the same that we call the EU defense mechanism, I think it would have been working. But since we are talking about trade, we're talking about investments, we're talking about money, definitely they would choose that above values.
Are we really that sad, Alva?
Well, I work for an organization that focuses on this, you know, arms sales around Yemen. I think it's a bit strange for a French foreign minister to be complaining about anybody else's arms embargo. It strikes me as being a bit of a faux pas, you know, that you should be talking about what Germany wants to do with its arms. And yeah, it's very...
Well, you've lost the battle if you can't talk to your closest ally about the problem you have with them and you have to moan about it publicly.
Publicly is strange. That's what I meant more. Yeah, I'm sure they say these things behind closed doors. But yeah, the situation in Yemen is terrible. And I think the whole thing around you're meant to be talking about stability, migration, and we're not actually talking about what the root cause of some of this is, which is conflict. Conflict which is fueled by arms sales from Europe to the region. And if that's not on the table, then I don't know. Yeah, how do you address migration if there are still conflicts like Syria, which has created 6 million refugees?
Well, another issue that has been hitting headlines in Brussels, but which you wouldn't have caught if you don't live here with us in Brussels, is a European Commission official who has been convicted of raping a junior female staffer who reported to him. He's been sentenced to 4 years in jail. Marcus Rajoya raped the victim at an office drinks event that was organized to celebrate the birth of his daughter. He's appealing the decision, and the commission says that it suspended him. It sent him home from the office as soon as the allegations were made. And in the meantime, the 3 years that have passed since then, he's been on his full salary, which is around about 15,000 euros a month gross. And the question really there is it right and is it due process that he should be employed and paid during that period, or now that he's been convicted, or when he goes through the appeal process, and if he is finally convicted at the end of all the appeals processes, should he be under some obligation to pay some of that taxpayer money back?
Definitely. I don't understand why they kept him even for 3 years, even if he was just suspended.
The official reason is that was the length of the legal proceedings. It wasn't the commission dictating that timeline.
It's still damaging for the reputation and the image of the commission. They would have taught a lesson for many officials that they're still doing their behaviors and nobody knows what's happening there. The Me Too movement and all what Brussels and the young female officials, whether in the parliament or in the commission, they are trying to make a code of conducts and trainings. I mean, there's a whole campaign, Ryan, on that. And then, yeah, the commission, no problem, stay 3 years and we're going to pay you 15,000 a month. They should definitely have cut it as a learning curve for the officials.
Alva, is this the price we have to pay to uphold good legal standards?
No, I think that you could. It really depends on what your contract says. And we know that functionaries have really quite, they have a lot of protection from a labor rights.
You do literally need to rape a colleague to lose your job.
Well, yeah, I mean, he didn't actually lose it. It was just suspended. So I imagine that there is some sort of a clause somewhere that says that, something like this happens, that you need to wait until legal proceedings are finished. So what a lot of other organizations would do, or employers would do, they would actually look into the allegations themselves and then figure out whether or not they believe them and then do it on the basis of that.
Yeah, what we know about the case is it's not really disputed that sex took place. It's just disputed whether it was consensual or not. So what you then have on the table is someone who was sleeping with someone far their junior in a position of authority, which in many organisations is enough to have someone out the door.
Yeah, and I wonder if it is enough to have people out the door if you're a functionaire, which is probably, you know, you sign up to something, but there's actually regulations about the staff and the commission. So it is probably that they just couldn't get rid of him. I'm sure they didn't want to keep him after this.
Yeah, they were very clear when we spoke on the phone that they were doing what they could within the legal means that they had, and that they wouldn't hesitate to take, quote, the appropriate action if he was finally convicted. Mm. And it was left to us to conclude what the appropriate action was. But I think you can all guess it means firing him.
Yeah, and I think this thing about the taxpayers' money, I mean, once you pay someone, they're not going to have to give it back, right? I mean, that's their own fault for not having fired him. So I don't think that could be the case. But it just goes to show that maybe this was before this code of conduct, because the commission now have a code of conduct as well, right?
Oh, they've always said they've had this code of conduct, like predating the original Harvey Weinstein and follow-on revelations going back 2 years.
Yeah.
They should fine him. At least, if he doesn't pay back the money.
He has been forced to pay compensation to the victim, 30,000 euros.
Yeah.
But that's not the commission. You're right. The commission hasn't extracted some kind of fine.
Yeah, I think it's probably just an unfortunate legal thing that's holding them from just firing him. Because, I mean, who wants to have someone on the books for 3 years, a now convicted rapist, in the books for 3 years?
With the title principal advisor. If I was one of the other 58 principal advisors of the European Commission, that would be devaluing my brand and my standing in the community to have that man with that title alongside me. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode. Next week, you can look forward to the first installment of a new regular feature. I'll be discussing European opinion polls with Cornelius Hirsch, the founder of pollofpolls.eu. And remember, podcasting is a team effort. This episode of EU Confidential wouldn't have been possible without Christina Gonzalez, Weidong Lin, and Andrew Gray.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.